This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Now, everyone knows about the Mamluks of Egypt. You know, a bunch of slaves who were bought from slave markets in Central Asia, and then they were trained into military arts, and then they became the generals and then the sultans themselves. Okay, this is what gave rise to the famous Mamluk dynasty, the Mamluks who fought the Crusaders as well as the Mongols, right? Yes. Later on, to protect or defend what remained of the Muslim civilization in the East.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. My name is Ahmed Ammar, and I would like to welcome you to the second episode of Ruh Revival, the McMaster Muslim Student Association's very own podcast series. Through this podcast, of course, as the name suggests, we hope to provide a source of Islamic revival for the Muslim student community and beyond. We hope to tackle some of the more difficult topics and answer the most burning questions that face our youth today. And of course, we will be doing this by leaning on people with any distinguished community members. We're going to be leaning on their expertise and their wisdom. And of course, without further ado, alhamdulillah, we have very happy to welcome our Ustad Adnan Rashid all the way from London, UK. Ustad Adnan, I'm going to be reading his, his bio so I don't make any mistakes. Ustad Adnan Rashid is a Pakistani-British historian and educator with a specialty in the history of Islamic civilization, comparative religion, and hadith literature. He embarked on his educational journey by pursuing a bachelor's degree in history from the University of London, followed by a master's degree in history and philosophy of science from the same university. He has gained ijazat in hadith from a number of scholars and has taken a keen interest in Islamic numismatics, that's coin collection, for those who don't know, and ancient manuscripts. He is not only a scholar, but a learned da'i, engaging in interfaith discussions with many high-profile figures in the field of politics, history, and Christian Islamic theology. If that was not enough, Ustad Adnan has also authored a short book called Islam's War and Terror, and is currently working on his next publication. Now we're going to be getting into the episode. The title of today's episode is going to be Beyond the British Raj, History of Islam in South Asia and the Indian Subcontinent. And we're going to be talking about, you know, the Mughals and their historical and political and Islamic importance. We're going to be then transitioning into the rule of the British that ended in 1947 and the Indian Independence Act. And then we'll focus on the contemporary and socio-political and religious struggles of Kashmir. So, Ustad Adnan, I don't want to be taking any more of your time, the audience's time. We'd very much like to hear what you hear what you have to say about the topic, basically. So I'm going to be starting us off, maybe with a brief introduction. Myself being an Arab Muslim, I speak on behalf of most Arabs when I say that we don't really know much about Islam in India. We know there's Muslims in India. We know Pakistan, alhamdulillah, almost all Muslim. How did Islam get there? Maybe tell us a bit about Islam, I guess, throughout. I know it's a big question, and we want to focus on the Mughals, but maybe a brief introduction so everyone's caught up to speed.
Thank you so much for inviting me for this podcast. It's my pleasure, my honor, to be able to discuss a topic that's very close to my heart. I have spent much of my life studying the history of Islam in the Indian subcontinent in particular, and I have studied the history of Islam elsewhere as well. Islam came to India, politically speaking, as a political power, as a political entity, almost a century after the Prophet of Islam himself. The Prophet of Islam passed away in the year 632 CE. By 711 CE, Muslims had already landed in India, current-day Pakistan, in the province of Sindh. This expedition, whatever the reasons were behind it, reasons have been debated and discussed by many different academics and scholars, and debates vary from scholar to scholar, person to person, sources are not very clear as to why the Muslims invaded this territory in the first place. There is a theory that there was piracy, and in response to piracy in the Arabian Sea, some Muslim merchants who were traveling from current-day Sri Lanka back to Arabia were basically attacked in the sea by pirates. And this kind of instigated this particular expedition to liberate some of those Muslims from the prisons or dungeons of these pirates. So Muhammad bin Qasim al-Thaqafi was sent as a general by Hajjaj ibn Yusuf, who was the governor of Iraq, the Umayyad governor of Iraq. So this expedition of five...
He was his nephew, right?
He was his nephew, yes. So these were 5,000 basically Muslims who came to basically free the Muslims, as the theory goes, okay? And they came, long story short, they fought some battles with local rulers, most importantly, a ruler called Raja Dahir or King Dahir. He was defeated and much of Sindh was occupied. It was conquered by the Muslims. So Muslims went as far as southern Punjab, current day Multan, and the Arabs ruled this territory for the next 300 years. Okay. Now, going through that history of 300 years is going to take a separate podcast, so we're not going to go get into that. Okay. But first the Umayyads came. Okay. The Umayyads sent their governors one after another. Okay, we had governors like Hakam bin Awana, we had Tamim bin Zayd al-Utabi, we had Amr bin Muhammad bin Qasim, the very son of Muhammad bin Qasim, the conqueror of Sindh. And then the list goes on, right? And we know the names of these governors by from two sources. One source is the literary source, the histories of the conquests. Okay, for example, one of them is Al-Baladuris, Futuh al-Buldan. Futuh al-Buldan mentions these names, just passingly. Very little information is provided. Unfortunately, we don't have details of the governorship or the rule of these governors in the Sindh territory of Pakistan or at that time, Greater India. Then we have coins. We have found numismatic evidence in the Sindh province. And these coins actually mention the names of these governors. I have coins in my own possession. You know, let me show off my coin collection.
Yes, for you guys.
Okay, so I have coins from Al-Hakam bin Awana. I have coins from Tamim bin Zayd al-Utabi. I have coins from Amr bin Muhammad bin al-Qasim. And again, this goes on. Then the Umayyads were basically, after the revolution, the Abbasid revolution, the Umayyad rule in Sindh declined. Then the Abbasids had to come back to reconquer much of Sindh again for Islam and Muslims. And then they ruled from a capital called Al-Mansura. Mm-hmm. The first capital of Islam in Sindh, or let's say in India for that matter, okay, was Al-Mahfuza. Mm-hmm. Al-Mahfuza, basically the protected one, literally meaning protected, Mahfuz in the Arabic language means protected, right?
Yes.
So Al-Mahfuza, the protected one, was a garrison town established by Al-Hakam bin Awana. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then after Al-Hakam, Amr bin Muhammad bin Qasim, Muhammad bin Qasim's son, made another capital, not very far from the first capital, called Al-Mansura. Mm-hmm. So Al-Mahfuza and Al-Mansura. So Al-Mansura remained the capital of Islam for at least 200 to 300 years, you know, so long as the Arabs ruled the province of Sindh. Okay.
So it's not to be confused with the Mansura in Egypt.
No, it's not. It's not. Not to be confused with the Mansura. This is the Mansura in India.
Yeah.
And there were coins minted at Al-Mansura, mm-hmm. some of which I possess, alhamdulillah. So then for 300 years, the Arabs ruled. Then came the Fatimids. Okay. They took some of this territory from the Muslims, okay, and they came to rule from Multan. Their capital was Multan, okay. Fast forward, Sultan Mahmud Ghaznavi from the city of Ghazna in Afghanistan, he decided to invade India for two reasons. One was to invade to gain wealth. This was an incursion to gain wealth. He was a king who needed money. Kings always need money to increase the number of their soldiers and expand their armies. So he came for that reason. One of the reasons was that. And the other reason was to subdue the Fatimid, the Ismaili, okay, government of Multan, which was threatening the Sunni Muslims in the region. So Sultan Mahmud Ghaznavi came for that reason. Having taken Multan and some parts of northwestern India, he established his capital at Lahore, the city of Lahore, current-day Pakistan. That remained the Ghaznavid capital for the next 200 years almost. Okay? So from the year 1000, let's say, to 1200, Lahore remained a very important city for the Ghaznavids, right? Then came another group of Afghan rulers and invaders called the Ghaurids. Okay? This was a family of rulers who ruled much of Afghanistan at the time, parts of Central Asia and parts of current-day Pakistan. So they came conquering lands. They took Lahore from the Ghaznavids, established their own government, and then they defeated the then ruler of northern India called Prithvi Raj Chauhan. This was a Hindu Rajput ruler who was defeated in battle. Okay, in the second battle of Tarain, he was defeated in 1192 CE. Okay, he was a near contemporary of Sultan Salahuddin. Sultan Salahuddin Ayyubi was, while he was fighting the Crusaders in the Middle East, the Muslim sultans of Afghanistan were invading territory into India. And this gave rise to what we knew later on as the Delhi Sultanate, the powerful Delhi Sultanate. Now, everyone knows about the Mamluks of Egypt. Mm-hmm. You know, a bunch of slaves who were bought from slave markets in Central Asia, and then they were trained into military arts, and then they became the generals and then the sultans themselves. Okay, this is what gave rise to the famous Mamluk dynasty, the Mamluks who fought the Crusaders as well as the Mongols, right? Yes. Later on, to protect or defend what remained of the Muslim civilization in the East, because the Mongols came devastating all the way from China to Syria, all the way to Syria. It were the Mamluks in the Battle of Ain Jalut in 1260, when the Mongols were decimated for the first time to that level, to that magnitude. Okay, so that Mamluk dynasty is very well known, mm-hmm. very well known. Okay, because of its deeds, great deeds, like the Sultan Baybars, a very famous sultan who was fighting the Mongols as well as the Crusaders simultaneously at the same time. He's the one who took some of the remaining strongholds of the Crusaders in the Middle East, and that's why the Crusaders had to leave once and for all from the Middle East. Okay, he's the one who ousted or basically expelled the Crusaders completely. Okay, very famous Mamluk general and ruler, Sultan Baybars. Okay. Now, the dynasty, the Mamluk dynasty of India is very little known, especially by the Arab world or to the Arab world and the rest of the Muslim Ummah in general. Most Muslims don't know as to what the Mamluk dynasty of India did and achieved. Similar to what Mamluks were doing in Egypt for Muslims and Islam, similar deeds were basically, or, you know, great achievements were done in India as well. Mongols, as they went invading the Middle East and, all the way up to Egypt, okay, they came to India as well. They invaded India. They were invading India for 100 years, starting from Genghis Khan himself. Genghis Khan came to India all the way to current-day Pakistan, pursuing the son of Sultan Khwarizm Shah. Jalaluddin Khwarizm Shah was the successor of Sultan Alauddin Muhammad Khwarizm Shah. He was the person who the Mongols defeated. The first king, the first sultan to be defeated by the Mongols was Alauddin Muhammad Khwarizm Shah, who died soon after. His son succeeded him, and he continued to resist the Mongol invasions. And Genghis Khan himself came pursuing him all the way to current-day Pakistan, near the city of Peshawar, and then he turned around. So the Mongols never stopped. They kept coming to India to take India from the Muslims. But the Delhi sultans, the Mamluks of Delhi, who ruled from Delhi as their capital, they stood like a wall of iron, or let's say brick wall. They stood in the way of the Mongols. They expelled the Mongols, they repelled the Mongols, they kept fighting. Many of them lost their family members in these battles, in these wars. To mention one very important case, Sultan Ghiyasuddin Balban, who ruled from 1266 to 1286 CE, right? This was the peak of the Mongol invasion. This period, India faced, you know, immense Mongol invasions of immense magnitude. So in one of these battles, the Sultan's own son, his heir apparent, his Waliul Ahd, was killed. Sultan Muhammad, or Prince Muhammad, he's called the Shaheed Prince in the history of India. He lost his life. And there was a famous poet, Amir Khosrow, Persian poet, who was in this battle present. He was an eyewitness. He describes this battle in his poetry. This is a very powerful, very rich history of Islam and Muslims. I mean, I'm skipping through a lot of detail, and I'm just, you know, basically hopping from sultan to sultan, from period to period, from dynasty to dynasty. Okay, you really have to look into, you know, some basic works to understand the Islamic or the Muslim history of India. I can quickly recommend a couple of books. One is by Richard Eaton. Eaton is spelled with E-A-T-O-N.
Oh, we know this. Yeah. Toronto Eaton Center.
Okay.
Canadians are familiar with Eaton.
Okay. So this scholar is called Richard Eaton. He's an American historian, and he has authored this recent book titled India in the Persianate Age. Persianate Age from the year 1000 to 1700, if I'm not mistaken, yeah, 1000 to 1700. So he documents the history of Islam in India for these 700 years, from the year 1000 all the way to 1700. Very powerful book. He calls it the Persianate Age because the language spoken at the time, the court language was Persian. Muslims were using the Persian language to do their administration and most work, even in literature.
Yeah, I think they always say Lughat al-Thalath. Yeah. Arabic, Persian, and
now Urdu.
Urdu, yeah. Used to be Turkish.
Now Urdu.
Urdu, mashallah.
In fact, Urdu has surpassed the Persian language when it comes to Islamic literature. I think the second most important language for Islam today is the Urdu language when it comes to the availability of literature.
Of course.
Okay, Urdu has pretty much most classical Arabic works translated into it. For example, we have the history of Tabari in Urdu entirely. Tariq al-Tabari is there.
Tabari.
Yeah. And we have Al-Bidayah wa Nihaya in Urdu. Okay, we have history of Ibn al-Athir. Usud al-Ghaba. Yeah, it's there. Okay. It's in Urdu.
Sahaba.
Yeah, yeah. Fi Ma'rafat al-Sahaba. Then we have, subhanAllah, Ibn Khalikan. That's also in Urdu. Ibn Khaldun is in Urdu.
Ahliyat al-Awliya or Sirah Alam Nabala.
No. Not these works.
Not
theological works.
Okay.
These major theological works are not necessarily in Urdu. You won't find Al-Mughni or Fathul Bari or, you know, Sirah Alam in Nabala. Yeah, these books are not in Urdu.
Okay.
But we have major literature translated into the Urdu language.
I mean, based on the names you mentioned, it seems that far surpasses the English.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, we have books of Shaykh al-Islam Ibn Taymiyyah in Urdu. Ibn al-Qayyim al-Jawziyah. We have his books in Urdu. Ibn Hazm, Al-Muhalla. Al-Muhalla has, last I checked, there were four volumes that were translated. So that's crazy work, right?
A lot of
Arab scholars don't know this, but a lot of this literature has been translated into the Urdu language.
There are a lot of native works as well.
Yeah.
Not just translations.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Not only translations. Original works have been authored by Muslim scholars from the Indian subcontinent, some so unique that they have to be translated into the Arabic language through Arab scholarship.
Like Aurangzeb's fiqh book. What was it called?
Al-Fatawa al-Hindiya.
Yeah.
You're talking about
Al-Fatawa al-Alamgiriya.
Yeah, that was originally in Arabic.
Oh, okay.
It was translated into Urdu
He and him and the scholars that he worked with.
Arabic.
Oh,
yeah, the original of Al-Fatawa al-Alamgiriya, also known as Al-Fatawa al-Hindiya, it is the largest collection of Hanafi fiqh in the world. Okay, I think it's the largest collection. You can say it's the Al-Mughni of the Hanafis. Okay, it's the At-Tamheed of the Hanafis. At-Tamheed is for the Malikis.
Yeah.
Yeah. For the Maliki, mashallah. Yeah. So there is a lot. I mean, a lot of people don't know this. A lot of the Arab scholars don't know this. That the Urdu language has surpassed all other languages when it comes to Islamic literature. Okay, and as you said, there are a lot of original works on specific topics. For example, Inkar al Hadith. Inkar al Hadith was an Indian phenomenon. It came from India.
Really?
Yeah, it came from the Indian subcontinent during the colonial period. It was started by Sir Sayyid Ahmad Khan. There was a man called Sayyid Ahmad Khan. He is the one who came up with some of these ideas to question the veracity of the Hadith literature. And then later on, some other people adopted it. And then it became pretty widespread within the Indian subcontinent. And that's why the books against this phenomenon were all mostly authored in the Urdu language. Right. So what we then this disease spread also into Egypt and other lands as well during the colonial period, of course. But
sorry, just to be clear, yeah. So Inkar al-Hadith in English is rejection of Hadith.
Yeah, Hadith rejection.
Yeah, just making
it. Yeah, absolutely. This is a very widespread phenomenon today as well. A lot of people, they reject Hadith altogether. Mm-hmm. Okay, they think Hadith literature is not trustworthy, and we've had debates with them. You can watch our debates. Mm-hmm. In Speaker's Corner, London, we've had some conversations with people from this background. Coming back to India, so sorry if I'm making it too long because we're going to get to our main topic. But this
That's
is
fine. Actually, yeah. if you don't mind, so Ustad Adnan, he has I forgot to mention this, but he has a YouTube channel. Mashallah, you go over many of what you mentioned. Many of the things that you mentioned, you have entire lectures about them. You have India, the British Raj, all these things. Hadith
rejection. As well.
This is all on his YouTube channel.
Yeah.
This is more like a teaser.
Yeah, absolutely. So these points I am mentioning today, passingly, you can find, as our beloved brother mentioned, that we have lectures on some of these topics. Hadith rejection, I have four episodes, four long lectures on this issue, and they are very important lectures. They are in the English language. I've been requested to do them in the Urdu language because that's where the real problem is. So I'm going to be doing that as well, inshallah, later on. So so the Delhi Sultans, they did great deeds for not only Islam and Muslims, but also for the people of India. Mm-hmm. Okay, Indians survived Mongol invasions because of the Muslim Sultans. They were spilling their own blood. One of the greatest battles in the history of Islam against the Mongols took place in India. Everyone knows about Ain Jalut. Every Muslim, or every Arab Muslim, let's say, knows about Ain Jalut because of the importance of the battle. Rightly so.
Saved the Muslim Ummah.
Exactly. Muslim Ummah was saved. But there was another battle that took place in 1299 when the Chagatais of Afghanistan. Chagatais basically were the descendants of Genghis Khan. Chagatai Khan was one of the sons of Genghis Khan, and one of his grandsons called Qutlug Khwaja. Qutlug Khwaja assembled the largest army of the Mongols to date in 1299, right? And he invaded Delhi, India. So the Sultan at the time was Sultan Alauddin Khalaji. Okay, Sultan Alauddin Muhammad Khalaji. He was the Sultan, and long story short, he defeated the Mongols. Okay. Because of one general, Zafar Khan, he basically attacked the Mongols and decimated about 5,000 of them. You know, 5,000 of the Mongols were killed in that very battle. And he himself lost his life with 1,000 men. The details can be watched on a very powerful video. There's a YouTube channel I strongly recommend for everyone, Kings and Generals. Okay,
my brother is obsessed with it.
Absolutely amazing. This is an absolutely amazing channel because they do a good job in telling history. So I want everyone to check out the Battle of Kili. The Battle of Kili, they have done an excellent video on this. The Battle of Kili, K-I-L-I. Okay, the Battle of Kili, Kings and Generals. Check it out. You'll be blown away. Like how important this battle was for the Muslims and their survival in India. And by extension, the Indians, the Hindus, right? They were depending on the Muslim sultans to defend them, to guard them against this imminent threat. Continuous threat, consistent threat. For 100 years, the Mongols kept coming. At times, every few months, they were invading India. The city of Lahore and Multan, you know, people know this. They don't know this, unfortunately. These cities were attacked repeatedly by the Mongols. And the Muslim sultans had a huge job. And I believe it were the Mongols who made the Delhi Sultanate so powerful. You know, when you have to defend yourselves against continuous threats, you become strong.
Yeah.
You become very strong. You know what Nietzsche said, Friedrich Nietzsche, you know, the German philosopher.
Yes.
He said, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that was the logic working there in India. Mongols kept attacking. The Muslims were defending themselves again. So now we want to move on to the latter period. The Delhi Sultanate survived from the year 1200 to 1526 until the Mughals came from Central Asia, another Sunni Muslim dynasty that ousted the Delhi Sultanate and their remnants, right? And then they came to power. Discuss, inshallah.
Yeah, so, okay, alhamdulillah, jazakumullah khair for going through that. I know it's a very, very rich history. We have like maybe 1,000 years of history in India. Okay, so the next question, maybe now that we've got to the Mughals, what's the best way to pronounce it?
Mughals, M-U-G-H-A-L. Mm-hmm. This is the best way to pronounce Mughals. It currently. Mughal is a word, is a Persian word, which is a corruption of the word Mongol.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so Mughal is basically Persianization of the word Mongol. Okay, and initially it was a derogatory term used by the British to describe the Mughals or the Timurids. The Mughals basically called themselves Timurids. They did not refer to themselves as Mughals. This was only later on in the 18th and the 19th century when they started to adopt this title for themselves.
Timurids from Timurling.
Yeah, Timurling. Yeah, mm-hmm. Timurlane or Timurling, who was basically a Central Asian conqueror in the 14th century, and he devastated much of the territory around him. He went as far as Europe and came to India and even went to the Ottomans and defeated one of the Ottoman emperors, Bajazid Yeldrim, the Thunderbolt. Okay, he was defeated in the Battle of Ankara by Timur, and the Ottoman Empire almost fell, completely disappeared, right? Because a 20-year civil war followed. So Timur was the ancestor of the Mughals. So the Mughals from Central Asia, from the current day Samarkand and Bukhara territory, they came into Afghanistan. The first Mughal emperor was called Zahiruddin Muhammad Babur. Okay, he was a direct descendant of Timur. Okay, by four or five generations. Okay, so he came into Afghanistan, took Afghanistan, and then he decided to invade India to attack one of the Muslim dynasties called the Lodi dynasty. Okay, and then he ousted the last Lodi ruler of the dynasty and took the city of Delhi for himself. This happened in 1526. The reason why he did this was because he had lost his own territory in Samarkand and Bukhara. It was called Fargana. That time the territory was called Fargana. Fargana Valley was actually taken by some of his relatives, his cousins and others who had taken this territory from him. So seeking a territory for himself, he came into Kabul. First he took Afghanistan, and then he decided that he needs to expand. So he went from Kabul to India. At that time was not a very huge distance. So he decided that he should carve another empire elsewhere. If not in Central Asia, it must be in India. So he came to India, and he only ruled for 4 years, and he died in 1530. Yeah, this is how the Mughal Empire started.
We interrupt this episode to bring you a message from Al Qalam, one of 10 directorships in the MSA in which we seek to celebrate Muslim students' culture and creativity. Our directorship holds initiatives throughout the year to expose the McMaster community to the rich history of Muslim communities worldwide. Some of the events that we've included are Turkish water marbling, embroidery, poetry, and calligraphy nights. And our year-long work ends with a culmination of the community's written and visual pieces in our magazine and year-end arts festival. The festival has art showcases, student performances, guest lectures. The opportunities are truly endless. And we really just want this to be a place where people can come and reflect on their lives in and out of the MSA. And it's also not only an opportunity for us to appreciate centuries of artistic traditions, but a way for us to come together to create new traditions. Now, every year, our magazine has a theme. And the theme for the 2023-24 year is Where We Gather, Our Truth, and Collective Heritage. Gatherings hold such an important part in our faith, whether this be gathering at an iftar table, at T13 to play ping pong, every Friday at DBAC to pray Jummah, or the profound experience of Hajj. Our community knows that when we gather for the sake of Allah, these gatherings are extraordinary. This theme explores how Islam, our truth, humanity's truth, is the central focus of our lives, bringing us together to build families, friends, and communities, despite our different race, culture, and birthplaces. We really want the community to explore the intricate threads that build and nourish our Muslim identities to create a heritage that's worth leaving. To stay updated on all things Al Kalam, follow our Instagram page, MacMSA_Al Kalam. We have very exciting developments coming up this year, inshallah.
I noticed you mentioned, you said Delhi. Now it's known as Delhi. So when did the change happen? I think I'm jumping the gun.
This is probably the British period, and later on, it's even called Delhi. Okay, to make it shorter. Okay, some people even call it Delhi, D-I-L-L-I. But the real name of the city is Delhi. Mm-hmm. Delhi, Dal Ha Lam Ya. Okay, D-E-H-L-I. This is the real pronunciation, or the original pronunciation, that we can find on ancient coins, like 800 years coins of the Muslims, 800 years old coins of the Muslims. You will see that Duriba Hadhihi Sikka. Okay, Bihazrat Delhi. This coin was struck in Hazrat Delhi. Hazrat is basically a title or a reference of respect to the city. So it was a very sacred city for the Muslims because of the number of saints and mystics who had come from Central Asia to Delhi. The reason why they came from Central Asia and Afghanistan to Delhi is because of the Mongol invasions. The Mongol came killing, decimating every single town and city on their way to Syria. So many of these people who lost everything, okay, among them were artists, scholars, architects, okay, brick workers, glass workers, bookmakers, scribes, poets, philosophers, intellectuals, you name it, the list goes on and on and on and on. All of this cream of the crop from Central Asia and Afghanistan ended up in Delhi. This is what gave rise to the powerful, the magnificent Delhi Sultanate. And that's why the sultans of the Delhi Sultanate became such powerful sultans. They had immense armies. They had some of the best soldiers, best scholars, best philosophers, best planners. That's why they lasted. That's why they lasted for so long, because they had the cream of the crop from the Muslim world. So some people ended up in Egypt and Syria because of the Mongol invasions. Yeah. And some people ended up in Delhi. Wherever they found the way to exit their territory, they basically found the quickest and the easiest exit to safer territories. Ibn al-Athir actually writes about some of these refugees escaping from Mongol invasions or surviving Mongol invasions. He found refugees in Mosul, the city of Mosul, and he described the condition.
My parents are from Mosul.
Oh, Allahu Akbar, yes. So Ibn al-Athir was in Mosul.
Yeah.
He was writing in Mosul.
Yes.
Okay, so he saw these refugees. He's an eyewitness. And he said, what I saw and what I heard about the suffering, my pen cannot write it. My hands shake before I write it. This is the obituary of Islam, basically, yeah. He said. This is the janazah of Islam.
I wish my mother did not give. He died 28 years before Ain Jalut.
SubhanAllah.
630, yes, and then 1260, yes.
But he had lived to see the Mongol invasions. Yeah. And he's one of the greatest historians of the Crusades as well. He writes about the Crusades and the Crusaders and Sultan Saladin Ayyubi as well. So he's one of our main sources, Ibn al-Athir. But he also saw the Mongol invasions and the aftermath. So this is what does this show us? This shows us that refugees from the Mongols, they basically ended up either in Syria or Egypt or in India. Yeah. That's why the Indian element Sultanate, the Delhi Sultanate, the Mamluks of India, they became so strong because they received all these, great scholars and thinkers and generals and you name it. You know, all of them ended up in India. Yeah, yeah.
It's very fascinating to see that these cities never fell to the Mongols. They plowed through Khwarizm. They massacred Baghdad. like the more
that was later, yes.
Yeah. So subhanAllah, it's amazing to see that.
By the way, one of the Mongol Khans, he actually, you know, accepted Islam. Mm-hmm. One of the greatest Mongol, one of the biggest Mongol Khans. His name was Barki Khan. Okay, he was one of the grandsons of Genghis Khan. He was the son of Jochi. Jochi was the eldest son of Genghis Khan. He never succeeded his father because of the doubt on his him being an actual son of Genghis Khan. The story is very long. Genghis Khan's wife was kidnapped during a raid by another tribe, and then Genghis Khan later on liberated her and took her back into his household. But it wasn't clear whether she got pregnant by the man who had kidnapped her or Genghis Khan. So from that, basically, was born Jochi, the eldest son of Genghis Khan. But it wasn't clear whether he was actually a son of Genghis Khan. That's why he never succeeded his father. But his son, Barki Khan, who was the ruler of the Golden Horde, that ruled all the way from Central Asia to Poland and Hungary, and this is a huge, vast territory, right? So he became a Muslim, and much of his army also accepted Islam. So the reason why you find Tatars in Mongol today and in Russia, in Russian states, to this day, Chinese-looking people, you know, Mongolians, they're actually Mongols, right, originally. They are Muslims. They are Sunni Muslims. The reason why they're Muslims is because the great Khan, Barki Khan, accepted Islam, and so did many of his generals and his men.
SubhanAllah.
Yeah.
So we talked about the beginning of the Mughals, how they came to power. Maybe before we talk about their decline, maybe some of the positives, some of what made them so unique. They led for a period of, what, 200 years almost?
Almost 200 years with strength. I would say, to be precise, almost 200 years, you can say, because Babur, he died in 1530. The first Mughal emperor who ruled only for 4 years, he died in 1530, and he left behind his son Humayun, okay? And Humayun ruled, his first reign was 10 years, okay, almost 10 years, and then the second reign was not very long, because then the Mughals were ousted by another dynasty, okay, that came to power for some period, nearly 15, 16 years. This is called the Suri dynasty. It was an Afghan general who rebelled against his Mughal overlords and ousted them, and then took power himself. Sher Shah Suri. His name was Sher Shah Suri, also known as the Lion King. Okay, Sher Shah literally means the Lion King. His real name was Farid Khan. Okay, and he was an Afghan general in the Mughal army. He had been serving the previous dynasty, the Lodi dynasty. Then he switched sides when Mughals came to power, so he started to serve the Mughals. But then he ousted the then Mughal emperor Humayun. Humayun took refuge in Persia, and then later on took advantage of the weakness and the civil war between the sons and the grandsons of Sher Shah Suri. So he came back. He saw his chance, and he took back India once again. So India, or the Mughal Empire in India, was reborn with the second coming of Humayun. Okay, so Humayun basically ruled for nearly a year, and he fell from the stairs of his library, and he died. So then came to power his 13-year-old son, Akbar, Jalaluddin Muhammad Akbar. So Jalaluddin Muhammad Akbar basically was 13 when he came to power. And he was illiterate. He had no knowledge of Islam, didn't know how to read and write, because he was on the run continuously with his father. His father lived a life of turmoil as a fugitive, right? Because he had to escape with his life from India when Sher Shah Suri came to power. And then he took refuge in Persia. And then when he came back to take his territory from his brother in Afghanistan, and then subsequently in India, he was on the run, and Akbar had no time to study, right? So now we have an emperor, a very powerful emperor, who doesn't know how to read and write. So he depended on people advising him, okay? So initially he was very religious, very dedicated to Islam, okay? But later on he started to change, you know, his mind started to change. He got some bad advisors, and those advisors started to, you know, flatter him, started to make him feel as if he's divine. He's divinely sent, he's divinely appointed, he has some divine characteristics. So he came up with his own cult called Deen-e-Ilahi, okay, which not many people followed. And the Muslim ulama were very concerned about the situation, okay? Because the emperor started to basically even despise Muslim scholars. And this is partly due to the Muslim scholars and the way they behaved at the time as well. The ones he knew at court, okay, the ones who were outside doing the tadris and ta'lim and madaris and institutions in India. So during the Mughal period, Islam flourished amazingly. Islam flourished. Islam spread. Many people accepted Islam. Okay, apart from the shenanigans the emperors are doing, okay, because the emperors are emperors. They have, you know, a lot of things going on in their lives. You know, they have... certain cultures to, certain protocols, let's say, okay, because they ruled a predominantly Hindu territory, okay. Hindus are the majority and Muslims are a minority. So they were ruling the Hindus, so they got married to Hindu women, they adopted Hindu culture in some cases. So Mughals were heavily influenced by the Indian culture, okay. So Akbar became immersed into that culture, then came his son Jahangir, who also... started to indulge in a lot of this culture. But Jahangir had to start, you know, he had to undo a lot of damage his father had done. Then came Shah Jahan, Jahangir's son, the father of the famous Aurangzeb Alamgir. Shah Jahan was a bit more Islamic or more Islamically inclined. Okay, he had more regard for Islam and Islamic scholars. Then came Aurangzeb. I mean, we are fast forwarding very, yeah, very quickly. Okay, I have a lecture on my YouTube channel called The Mughal Empire. People can watch that. I have a lecture on Aurangzeb Alamgir where I cover some of this history as well. So people, please don't feel frustrated if we are hopping from emperor to emperor in sentences, okay? Because each of these emperors, you know, they need maybe 5 to 6 podcasts of their own.
Exactly. Yeah. We won't be able to do them justice in 5 minutes.
We're not going to be able to do that. Yeah. We're just mentioning them so that you know who they are. Okay.
By the way, Shah Jahan is the one we have to thank for the Taj Mahal.
Shah Jahan is the one who built Taj Mahal in memory of his wife, his beloved wife. He loved her so much that even when he was later on put under palace arrest by his own son Aurangzeb, he requested that he's put somewhere where he can actually look at the Taj Mahal. So he spent the last 7 years in palace arrest. Why? Is another question. Yeah. You have to watch my lecture on Aurangzeb Alamgir. Why Aurangzeb actually put his father in palace arrest. A lot of people have this idea that Aurangzeb killed his blood brothers and put his father in prison. And he was a very cruel man, very, you know, selfish and self-centered kind of ruler. No, that's not the case. If you study his history carefully, objectively, and one of the biographies is authored by an American scholar. Her name is Audrey Trushk. Audrey Trushk has written a brief biography of Aurangzeb Alamgir in the English language. So it's a good read. So you must look into it.
By the way, for those people who don't like to read, it's only 100 pages.
Yeah, it's not a lot. And, you know, earlier I was going to mention the books. I will mention them very quickly. I mentioned Richard Eaton's India and Persianate Age. Okay, and there was another book I would like to mention is Islam in South Asia by Jamal Malik. Islam in South Asia by Jamal Malik. Very good book. A very good, you know, treatment of the history of Islam in the Indian subcontinent. Then if you want to read a basic book on the Mughals, then there is an author called John F. Richards. John F. Richards has a book titled The Mughal Empire. Okay, just put Richards and Mughal Empire in Google, you'll see the book I'm talking about, okay? The Mughal Empire is a very good introduction to the Mughal Empire, what the Mughals did and where they came from, okay? And the Delhi Sultanate, if you want to read books on Delhi Sultanate, they are a bit complicated, but Jamal Malik's book is a good one. Jamal Malik's good is a book one, okay? So moving from Shah Jahan, you see these two reigns, Jahangir and Shah Jahan, they were very important in the Mughal period. This was the peak of the Mughal Empire, the peak of prosperity, the peak of military dominance, the peak of, let's say, Islamic activism. You know, a lot Islam spread. A lot of scholars were writing books at this time, writing tafsirs in the Persian language. They were writing commentaries on the Quran. They were writing commentaries on the Hadith literature.
So the peak was before Aurangzeb?
It started before Aurangzeb. You know, Aurangzeb didn't come from a vacuum.
Of course
he didn't just appear one day and say, look, I'm Islamic today. No. Aurangzeb had basically learnt or studied with scholars who were already there, active during his father's reign. And it were those scholars who prospered during Shah Jahan's reign who started to defend and side with Aurangzeb during the civil war. Okay? So I would like to very, very quickly give you a brief summary of what happened. At that time, the principle between the Mughal princes was that if the father dies, the emperor dies, then you have to fight it out.
Which is common for the Ottomans as well, right?
Basically, this tradition came from Central Asia. Mm-hmm. This is a Turkic tradition. You have to fight it out. You want to rule, fight it out. You have to fight your way to the throne. Okay, so the Mughals and the Ottomans and the Turkish dynasties like Timurids and all, they all followed the same protocol. It's not necessarily Islamic. It's not necessarily Islamic, okay? This method of succession came from the Turks, okay, from Central Asia. So the Mughals, because they were Turkic, the Ottomans, because they were also Turkic, but the Ottomans came up with a new solution afterwards, what we call fratricide, okay? They started to kill their siblings to do away with the problem. Okay, the Ottomans, they realized that if they keep having rebellions, the state cannot make progress. Okay, so to protect themselves against these rebellions, they started to commit fratricide. They basically would choose their siblings, their brothers or their cousins who would threaten the state or who had the potential to threaten the state. They would simply execute them. They would strangle them. Okay, so this is a very disturbing episode in Ottoman history, no doubt. Okay. But this was adopted for pragmatic reasons. I'm not justifying it. It's not Islamic, okay? But the fatwa was given by the ulama at the time that you can do it to save hundreds of thousands of lives. Because what would happen if a prince rebelled against the emperor, the sultan? As a result, hundreds of thousands of people would die during the civil wars because cities would be devastated. They would be bombed. They would be, you know, they were Ottomans-like. They were, you know, superpowers. Even the princes, they had a lot of power. They had their own states. Right. Similarly, Mughals basically follow this protocol. Ya takht, ya tabut. Okay. It's either the throne or the box, basically. The box as in the coffin. You know, you either go to the grave or you go straight to the throne. So Aurangzeb Alamgir had no choice but to fight it out. So he had to fight three of his brothers, Shah Shuja, Murad Bakhsh, and Dara Shikoh. Dara Shikoh was on the same trajectory as his great-grandfather, Akbar. Okay, he wanted to synchronize Islam with Hinduism. Basically, he wanted to create a new religion, potentially. And the ulama were alarmed. The ulama, they knew what trajectory Dara Shikoh wants to put India on, right? Yes. So they sided with Aurangzeb, who was very religious. Aurangzeb was the best choice of the ulama. They backed him, they defended him, and they sided with him in war, and they even asked for people to support him because he promised an Islamic domain.
SubhanAllah, this idea of trying to combine religions is not something that's alien to us, unfortunately. You see that very commonly nowadays. But that's a bit tangential. it's just a very sad reality. Okay, so for the sake of time, maybe I can combine my questions. I wanted us to go over maybe some of the things that led to the downfall of the Mughals so that we may hopefully, what's the point of history is just to learn from the mistakes, to be able to identify the patterns and to learn from it so we don't repeat the mistakes. So maybe talking a bit about what led to the fall of the Mughals and what led to the, inception of the British rule over India.
Brilliant. Okay, good question. You see, what was the peak of the Mughals, we have to first understand before we discuss the fall. The peak period, you can say, lasted from 1556 to 1707 until Aurangzeb was alive. Okay, this is the peak period. This is when the Mughals were at the peak of their power. This is when Mughals created the greatest monuments like Taj Mahal, Badshahi Mosque of Lahore, the Lal Qila, the Red Fort of Delhi, and the city of Fatehpur Sikri. All of these great architectural artistic monuments were developed, created by the Mughals during this period. The Mughals had had reached the pinnacle of their civilization, what we call the Mughal civilization, at this period. You can say it's pretty much about 150 years. From 1556, when Akbar came to power, and until when Aurangzeb died in 1707. Aurangzeb ruled from 1658 to 1707, nearly 50 years, 49 years to be exact. Okay, so in these 50 years, Aurangzeb pretty much took most of India. Mughals never ruled that much land in India until Aurangzeb took it. Aurangzeb ruled pretty much 95% of India. The only parts left were the jungles in southern India, Tamil Nadu jungles, where Aurangzeb and his military couldn't penetrate those jungles. But they took pretty much all of urban areas and remote areas of India. You know, so, and that's why Aurangzeb Alamgir spent nearly 25 years of his life in southern India. He never came back to Delhi. For 25 years, he was absent from the capital. Can you imagine? Just because he was fighting wars and battles in southern India, trying to subdue the Marathas, who became a very big power later on, okay, and other local tribes in southern India. So Aurangzeb was the most Islamic king, the most Islam-observing king. That would be a better way to put it, okay? It was during Aurangzeb's reign when Al-Fatawa al-Alamgiriya was compiled at the orders of the emperor. He's the one who patronized the whole project. A number of ulama, Hanafi ulama from the Indian subcontinent, they came together and they compiled this compendium of Hanafi fiqh, which to this day is referred to. And of course, this knowledge was taken from previous books. Okay, Fatawa Qazi Khan and Fatawa Tatar Khania, and there were other Hanafi compendiums. That's where the sources, the knowledge came from. And one very quick question I want to address is, like, how did the Hanafi school of thought become prominent in India? Why in India? Okay, you see, Islam came to India in three, how can I put it, episodes. The first was during the Arab period. The Arabs were pretty much, you can say, you know, they followed the earliest version of Islam, which was the Quran and the Sunnah, the Arabs when they came in, right? Because even the schools of thought were not established, okay? In 92 Hijri, when Muhammad bin Qasim came to Sindh, you know, Imam Abu Hanifa would have been 12 years old, mm-hmm. Okay? Imam Malik wasn't even born yet.
Two years before,
94. Imam Malik was born 94, 93 or 94?
93, because Anas bin Malik died the same year Imam Malik
was born. Yeah, yeah. I mean, some people say 94, some people say 93. Yeah, yeah. So it's like, let's say 93.
I trust your...
I mean, the year I remember is 94. When Anas bin Malik died in 94, okay. And the same year Imam Malik... So Anas bin Malik dies and Malik bin Anas is born. Yeah. Basically. Just like Imam Abu Hanifa died in 150 and Imam Shafi is born the same year. Okay. So... So these guys, these early Arabs, they followed, radiallahu anhum ajma'in, they followed the early version of Islam, the Quran and Sunnah, whatever they could receive from the Prophet and his companions, they followed that. Later on, when the Ghaznavids came, when they took land of Multan from the Ismailis, they brought the Shafi'i school of thought with them. So the Ghaznavids were Shafi'i because the scholars at the court were mostly Shafi'i. Ghaznavids were Samanid vessels. Again, this is a very long story. People might be thinking, what is going on here?
The history of the Madhahab is very interesting. Absolutely. And it's very political as well.
Absolutely. Very political and very circumstantial as well. Mm-hmm. Now, how did the Hanafi school come to India is the question. Again, the Mongol invasions. All the cream of the crop from Central Asia, okay? And the greatest scholars of Hanafi fiqh or Hanafi school were in Central Asia. This territory, this region was called Mawara'un-Nahar, basically land beyond the river. Which river? The river Oxus, Transoxonia. That's why this region is called Transoxonia. So that's these scholars, they either went to the land of Syria or they came to India. And lo and behold, the Hanafi school of thought.
So the Shafi'is went to Syria, the Hanafis went to India?
The Shafi'is left with the Ghaznavids.
Yeah.
They left with the Ghaznavids, right? So the Delhi Sultanate was predominantly a Hanafi enterprise.
Okay.
Okay, that's why the Mughals later on also
adopted
what was already there.
Okay,
so that's why Al Fatawa Al Alamgiriya is a compendium of Hanafi fiqh, right? So Hanafi fiqh was dominant in India until some other schools of thought came about, primarily with people like Shah Waliullah Dehlavi, who was also born when Aurangzeb Alamgir was on the throne. Okay, so Aurangzeb Alamgir, he had been influenced by scholars. And he even imposed jizya and even minted dirham shari'i, 4 grams of silver for that purpose. So he tried a lot of these things, okay? And he is the most hated Muslim king by the current Hindutva, extremist Hindu, right-wing, almost terrorist kind of people who hate him because of his excessive Islam. Okay, the only reason he's hated the most is because he was the most Islamic king in the history of India. The second most disliked Indian Muslim king is Tipu Sultan, again because of his excessive love for Islam. That's another episode in itself. Okay, that's another podcast. Okay, so the Mughals basically ruled with iron fist, or you can say with much success and power and prosperity, up to the point when Aurangzeb was alive. Aurangzeb dies in 1707, then comes to power his son, Bahadur Shah, who rules for another 5 years, and then he dies. Then all hell was broken loose, like, you know, all these princes, Mughal princes, they became puppets into the hands of ruling families around northern India, and then they started to basically fight each other. Okay, long story short, within the next 50 years, almost 13 emperors sat on the Mughal throne.
Allah had 49 years of one person, and then...
No, you had 150 years of 4 emperors.
Yes.
150 years with 4 emperors. You have Akbar, you have Jahangir, you have Shah Jahan, and Aurangzeb. 4 emperors sat on the Mughal throne for 150 years, hence the stability. Yes. Hence the stability. But after the death of Aurangzeb, from 1707... to 1757, in these 50 years, 13 Mughal emperors sat on the throne. Some of them for a few months. Like, one of them have even sat on the throne for like 2 months. Okay, so this was the chaos that followed. The Mughals declined because they started to fight each other. They started to become puppets into the hands of king-making families like Sayyid Brothers. One example is Sayyid Brothers. Then there were some other powerful ruling elite, you know, who were trying to use these emperors as puppets for their gains. And that's why it was very easy to now put an emperor on the throne and remove him, you know. So these guys would come, the Sayyid Brothers, okay, there were 2 brothers. Who became very powerful, very influential, they would put an emperor on the throne, okay? And if they didn't like him, if he wasn't listening to them, he wasn't toying their line, okay, he would just be removed and another emperor would be put. So Muhammad Shah, who ruled for almost 30 years, from 1719 to 1748, okay, he had realized that until he neutralizes the Sayyid brothers, he cannot rule. So he decided to do away with the Sayyid brothers, and then he ruled for 30 years. This was the longest reign after Aurangzeb Alamgir. But the problem is, actually, Shah Alam II was longer, but this was with some level of influence and power. It was during his reign, Muhammad Shah's reign, when the most devastating event in Mughal history took place. The city of Delhi was taken by the Persian ruler, called Nadir Shah. In 1739, Nadir Shah invaded India and he took the city of Delhi and he broke the back of the Mughals, basically. Whatever remained of Mughal prestige and Mughal power, he took it away. Then followed a reign or a period of land-grabbing enterprises. Okay. So these land-grabbing enterprises basically were initiated by a number of different foreign and local dynasties. The Sikhs declared their independence in the Punjab. The Marathas in central India, they started to take territory from the Mughals, and so did the British, who were there thus far watching and waiting for their opportunity to come in and take as much land as they could. And in 1757, they defeated the then Mughal governor of Bengal in battle. The battle was called the Battle of Plassey. And thenceforth, the British slowly and steadily took pretty much all of India within 100 years. Okay, this is how the British Empire came about. Firstly, it was ruled, the British Empire or the British Raj consisted of the government of East India Company. It was a trading company. It was a trading enterprise. And one of the best books on this is titled Anarchy by William Dalrymple. So you can look into that book. That documents the history of the East India Company, how the East India Company as a trading enterprise took land from the Mughals in India and started to rule India as a trading prospect. And then it was only after the mutiny of 1857 when the British government in London took full control of India, because they didn't want a trading company to rule a country of that size as a trading prospect anymore.
Because at the time, India was the richest country in the world when they came, right?
Absolutely. When Aurangzeb died in 1707, India was the richest country in the world. It had 24% of global GDP. And when the British left in 1947, okay, they left India with 4% of global GDP. 4%. From a quarter of the global wealth to 4% of it.
SubhanAllah.
Yeah.
And I think, yeah, Muslims mourn, rightfully so, the loss of Andalus, of course, but the loss of India, which the Muslims have led or ruled for, what, 1,000 years? And I think it's the best example of, or best proof against the people with the notion that Islam is a warmongering, bloodthirsty religion. You have 1,000 years of Muslim rulership, and the country started off as a Hindu majority and ended up as a Hindu majority.
Absolutely.
You contrast that with Spain.
Yeah.
Exact opposite.
Exactly. Exactly. Even in Spain, Muslims were completely forcefully converted by the Spanish Catholic monarchs. Okay. Ferdinand and Isabella, they came and they made treaties with the Muslims. They promised security and protection of religion. But as soon as they came to power and Muslims dropped their weapons, all of them were forced into Catholicism, forcefully converted to Catholicism, and they became a race course. That's another story in itself.
That's another story, which you have videos about as well.
Exactly. I have a video. I mean, you're making me realize how much work I've done, alhamdulillah. Sometimes I forget myself.
May Allah bless you. MashaAllah, when I came across your channel, it is definitely a gold mine for
inshallah.
History lovers, and as Muslims, we should all be history lovers.
Yeah.
Of course, I want to apologize to the audience. We won't get time to go through everything, but every topic we mentioned, you have a video on. So you have a mashallah over two-hour video about the British Raj, how it came to be, and the devastating effect it had on India. You have, of course, we wanted to talk about Kashmir, but unfortunately, we won't get the time. But you have a whole, I think, hour, 10-minute lecture or something about Kashmir and
the history of Kashmir. Yes,
I think we said that we want to touch upon the most burning questions, and I think, in light of what's happening to our brothers and sisters in Gaza, and of course, the Kashmir issue, which has been ongoing for over 50 years now, and of course, all the revolutions here, you as a student, you sit here, and every time, I feel like sometimes we forget.
Yes.
As time goes by, and then the wound is reopened through the news, and then you're thrown into that frenzy of what can I do, where do I sit, stand in all of this. And then again, Manny, it's an ongoing cycle.
Absolutely.
So what can we do? The question.
What we can do is educate ourselves. First of all, we need to learn about the history of Palestine and the history of Kashmir and understand what's really going on. Okay. And then what we need to do is we need to do positive activism. We need to educate people about it. The media is clearly in the wrong hands. Okay. They don't do it. If anything, they want to completely brainwash the masses into thinking the complete opposite of the situation on the ground. Okay, so that's why it's very important for us to educate ourselves and then educate the masses. We need to go active on social media. We need to write letters to our MPs and our prime ministers. We need to raise awareness not only at university campuses, but also reach out to the masses somehow, the normal, the common people, the common man. Okay, we don't have access to mainstream media. We don't have access to CNN and Fox News and NBC and Sky News and BBC. We don't have access to these platforms. But we do have access to social media, right? That's when they will start to listen to us, okay? So we need to raise our voice. Silence is not an option, okay? Lack of activism is not an option. Okay, you cannot remain silent in the face of oppression and injustice. You must speak against injustice. Okay, so you need to know your circle of influence. You need to know how much you can actually do. And whatever you can do within your capacity, do your best to raise awareness. Awareness is the best thing you can do. Once enough people are aware of the situation and they know where the injustice is, things will start to change. Pressure will build. And inshallah, these oppressive, tyrannical governments will realize that they have to give freedom where it's due. Okay, whether it's Kashmir or Palestine, once people are aware of the situation of the people there, most people in the world don't know what's happening in Gaza. They think people of Gaza just, you know, they're just a bunch of spoiled, people, and they're not grateful to their well-wisher called the State of Israel. They don't know what's happening in Gaza. Gaza has been under siege for the last 16 years. Okay? They don't have access to medicine. They don't have access to basic human needs. They are drinking sewer. They don't have clean drinking water. Okay? So just like our brother Muhammad Hijab said in one of his recent interviews, that it's like you come into someone's house, you force them into the toilet, and then force them to drink sewer while you have a party in the living room, right? And then when they want to come out of the toilet and take some part of the house, or the house that belongs to them, you call them terrorists. You start to kill them. You start to beat them up. Why? How dare you come out of this toilet? Remain in the toilet and thank us for keeping you in the toilet. You must thank us for keeping. And if you squeal or if you make any noise, we'll come hard on you. So this is the situation. Same in Kashmir. Kashmir, the people of Kashmir are in no different situation. They don't have the freedoms we enjoy. Okay, their youngsters live in a state of fear. Okay, Kashmir is the most heavily militarized area in the world. If it's a democracy, why do you need to keep nearly a million soldiers in this little territory called Kashmir? Why? Because you're suppressing oppressing people. That's why. You're suppressing their will. You're suppressing their desire to live free. Give them freedom. Let them choose how they want to live. You talk about democracy. India, ironically, everyone talks about democracy, the democratic values in India, and Israel is the greatest democracy in the Middle East. These are the two democracies that need to think about what democracy actually means. Are you giving democratic rights to the Palestinians? Okay, Palestinians are not necessarily Democrats. They may be some Muslims don't even believe in democracy, the system called them. But if you hold on to these values and you celebrate them, let them show in your actions. In your actions, how you treat others. That's the point.
Jazakallah khair, Ustaz. And wallahi, if we had the time, I would have loved to double the duration of the interview, but unfortunately we have to wrap up. Jazakallah khair, very, very beneficial, informative discussion. I hope that you guys benefit. And we will be putting links in the description if you're watching on YouTube. We're going to be having links to all the lectures that we spoiled or gave a spoiler for or mentioned. Jazakallah khair.
Thank you so much for having me. It's my pleasure, my honor. And we would like to do more, inshallah, when Allah permits.
Inshallah. Whenever you come, more than happy to host you.
Inshallah.
I'll be honored to host you. Jazakallah khair.
Jazakallah khair.
Yes, so this episode will be on, will be posted on YouTube.
It'll be on my channel as well.
Yes, it'll be on the Mac McMaster and Mac MSA YouTube channel, on Ustad Adnan Rashid's YouTube channel. It'll also be on Spotify. Assalamu alaikum, jazakum khair for listening.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.